Welcome to The Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh, copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning Episode 8 on page 100 of this 247-page book. In our last episode, Barbara described in detail the first photos she had ever seen of her grandfather Ambrose, and other pictures of her grandmother and dad, all taken many years ago. Flashing back again to Marystown, Newfoundland, in 1935, Lillian Walsh has just said goodbye to her husband Paddy, but with terrible fears for him on his fishing journey. Finally, again in 2003, Barbara, her sister Joni, and their father have arrived at Logan Airport for their flight to Newfoundland. Now, Episode 8. Hours later, in the small Air Canada plane, I stare at the dark blue sea and consider the Titanic, which lies somewhere deep in the dark caverns below. Though it is one of the most memorable ships to have sunk off Newfoundland's coast, it is but one of the 10,000 or more vessels that have shipwrecked or disappeared in these waters since the 16th century. North of the 40-degree latitude, sailors contend with more than a wild and unpredictable sea. Year-round, icebergs drift south from Greenland and along Newfoundland's east coast. Monster mountains of ice, they can tear a ship in two. In the summer months, the collision of the warm Gulf Stream and the cold Labrador Current creates curtains of fog, relentless and thick banks that shroud fishermen and boats for days, leaving them lost and at risk of deadly collisions with other vessels. And then there are the rogue waves, freaks of nature that tower 70, 80, and sometimes even 90 feet high, carrying a lethal force capable of capsizing and destroying cruise liners, tankers, and 300-foot-high oil platforms. Ever present along the island's 6,000 miles of coastline in good weather and bad, there are numerous sunkers, deadly reefs hidden below the ocean's surface. Thousands of years ago, glaciers stripped Newfoundland's soil and cast the deposits into the sea, creating the underwater ledges that threaten unwary captains and ships tossed about by storms and violent hurricane winds. I picture Paddy in these fierce and unforgiving waters, a skipper who had shipwrecked in heavy seas, sailed through blinding fog, and remained trapped for weeks in winter ice floes. With nothing more than his compass, charts, and the glass, the barometer that foretold foul weather, he sailed these seas for much of his life. I imagine him on his schooner, Annie Anita, on his August journey, a careful eye trained on the sky and the sea, searching for a change in the current, a shift in the wind, a gale that might descend without warning. And like many other August gales, the 1935 hurricane roared up the North Atlantic coast with a vengeance. In our research, my father and I have recreated bits and pieces of the gale. We have collected newspaper stories, talked with dozens of relatives, and have read first-hand accounts about the hurricanes that have plagued Newfoundland's coast for centuries. For much of our flight, my father has dutifully reviewed our material. He has studied notes from my interviews and reread the Marystown census names. He has pulled papers from his leather-zippered briefcase, methodically reading each page. From my own files, I have scanned notes from my phone conversations with Marystown residents. I am eager to see their faces, these children who lost fathers, grandfathers, uncles, and brothers to the gale. I am anxious to glean more details from their memories, to hear them talk about the storm that forever changed their lives and their small rural outport. I am curious, too, about our relatives, the Brentons, who invited us to use their summer cabin during our stay. A month or so before our trip, my father contacted his cousin, Alan Brenton, to let him know we would be coming. Brenton's mother, Donalda, was Ambrose's older sister. My Nana wrote her several letters and developed a long-distance friendship with Donalda through their correspondence. Alan Brenton, like most of his Newfoundland relatives, had been fond of his Uncle Ambrose, and he looked forward to meeting my father. 9 years earlier, Brenton had met my Uncle Bill when he made an unexpected trip to Newfoundland. Wanting to know more about his namesake, William Patrick Paddy Walsh, my uncle surprised Brenton with a phone call. "I'm William Patrick Walsh, Ambrose's son," my uncle told Brenton. "I'm in Newfoundland. I'll be in Marystown in a few days." Brenton invited my uncle and his family to stay with him, and one evening over dinner and drinks, Brenton asked, "Do you think your brother Ron would ever come to Marystown?" My uncle shook his head, knowing my father's feelings about travel and Ambrose. "It may come to the point sometime in my life where I could forgive my father," my uncle explained, "but I don't think my brother Ron would ever forgive him." Now, 13 years later, I sit next to my father on a small plane headed for Newfoundland. I turn to him, eyeing the gray hair that peaks beneath his navy baseball cap, dressed in khakis and a blue sweatshirt adorned with large yellow letters that also proclaim Navy. He is a few months shy of celebrating his 68th birthday. I hope this trip will be an early gift for him, a chance to understand, to know his father better, a chance to consider forgiveness. As the pilot pulls back on the throttle, slowing the plane's engines, the red light over our seats pings, warning us to buckle our seat belts and prepare for landing. I pull my belt tighter and wonder what Brenton and others will say to my father about Ambrose, and what my dad will say in return. My father glances out the window at the massive island that is now beneath us. He shifts his weight and sighs, knowing we will soon be among Ambrose's relatives, people who are fond of the man who remains a mystery to me and provokes a long-standing bitterness in my father's heart. Would my dad turn this plane around if he could? Would he abandon this trip now if Joni and I were not with him? Hoping to offer him reassurance, I reach for my dad's hand. His eyes meet mine, and I ask, "Did you ever think you'd be coming to Newfoundland?" Though he does not have to think about his answer, my father speaks slowly, "Not in a million years." We both fall silent again, and I turn to the window so he will not see my tears. Wiping the drops from my cheeks, I look across the aisle toward the back of the plane, searching for Joni. She is seated a few rows behind us, and is the picture of calm. She harbors no worries about this trip. She is eager to meet our Newfoundland relatives and to connect with our past. Noting my concerned face, she offers a smile. I smile too, but my heart is far from at ease. I pull my seat belt tighter as the plane's wheels kick open with a thud, preparing for its arrival in St. John's, Newfoundland's capital city. I close my eyes and whisper a silent prayer, bracing for the landing and an uncertain journey to my grandfather's homeland. Chapter 13. Mustering Courage on Board Annie Anita and Mary Bernice, August 21, 1935. The sails clapped like thunder in the wind. "Hoist the main!" Paddy shouted to his crew. Frankie Walsh cast his eyes heavenward, following the canvas sail as it soared up the 60-foot mast. Two of the crew groaned as they tugged on the halyards, securing the sheet. The southeast wind at their backs, the sails held taut against the breeze. Waves slapped the bow, sending sea spray onto the deck as Annie Anita glided through the bay. "We're underway, boys!" Paddy hollered to Frankie and Jerome. Jerome ran to his father, eager to stand at the helm. Frankie kept his place. He leaned against the stacked dories, mindful of the crew that scurried about him. He did not want to get tangled up in a line or trip up the men. The 12-year-old boy drew a deep breath to calm the worries that bubbled up inside him. Searching for a distraction, he looked toward the stern where his father stood, his large hands on the wheel, his eyes focused on the schooner's course. Frankie reckoned his da's mind was busy now, thinking on where he'd find the fish, where he'd drop the anchor once they hit Cape St. Mary's. The journey, Frankie knew, would begin slowly at first, as the schooner traveled east in the protected inlet that wound its way past Marystown, Little Bay, Beaubois, and Tides Point before sailing into the vast open sea. Wanting one last look at his home, Frankie turned west and glimpsed the whitewashed house on the hill as it faded from view. His mother would have risen early, poured herself a cup of tea, and gazed out the window, watching for their parting sails. The thought of her without them, the three eldest boys and their father, saddened him, for he knew her heart would be heavy with worry during the week they were gone. Jerome had tried to comfort her before they left. "We'll be fine, Mom. We'll be home soon enough." Frankie only offered her a quiet, "So long, Mother," and a quick hug goodbye. She had not wanted to let them go, delaying their departure, packing and repacking their duffels with extra woolens, caps, mittens, and their Sunday suits, in case they stopped in a church or somewhere proper along their journey. On top of their clothes, she carefully placed their pocket Bibles. "Read the good book before bed and on Sunday, and don't forget your prayers." "Yes, ma'am," they had told her. No, Frankie would not forget his prayers. He prayed to the Lord over the past week, pleading for courage. The boy tried to embrace the sea like his father and two older brothers, but he was not fond of how the ocean changed so quickly. It could be calm, safe, like the bay outside his home, and then it could be dark, with ragged waves that grew taller than a ship's masts. Last summer's journey with his dad had been miserable. The sea swells and the constant motion of the schooner had brought on the queasiness and trips to the bucket at all hours of the day and night. His father tried to comfort him. "Keep your eyes focused on the horizon, me boy." But the advice did little good. Frankie came home red-faced, shamed. The lads at school had been ruthless with their taunts. "Sissy, seasick sissy, are you sure you're Captain Paddy's son? Ye ought to be staying home with your mamma." Frankie heard their voices in his mind now, as the wind rose and cold water sprayed his cheeks. "Stand tall," Frankie told himself. "You're Captain Paddy's boy. This August journey will be different. This time I might even have some adventures aboard Annie Anita. Perhaps I will have some stories to tell the fellows back home about the cod I hauled, the dory I rowed." "Frankie," Jerome hollered, "there's Tide's Point. We're almost to the sea." Paddy grinned as his boys raced to port to view the red-and-white-striped lighthouse that rose up from its perch atop a cliff. The sight never ceased to stir Paddy's heart. The last protected cove, Tide's Point, bordered the sea, heralding the start of the journey, the beginning of the adventure, and a freedom that he could never taste on shore. Paddy remembered the joy he experienced on his first trip with his own father, Tom Walsh. A boy of 12, he was awed by the wild and unpredictable sea, the challenge of finding the fish, and the fierce competition among the dorymen and skippers. Oh, how he loved standing on board, watching his father race back to Marystown, wanting to be the first to return with a boatload of cod. His love for fishing and the sea grew with every sail, every journey. "You're a natural son, a born fish-killer," Paddy's father had told him. When he returned from Boston, a man in his 20s with a few years' apprenticeship behind him, Paddy was confident and prepared to take on the job of a skipper, and he soon learned there was no greater calling than to command a vessel, command a crew. Ye felt like a king in charge from dawn to dusk, fighting the seas that could be your friend or foe. And no matter the conditions, calm waters, gales, fierce wind, or tick of fog, Paddy always found the fish. His reputation had spread far and wide from Newfoundland's shores. His legend grew with every catch, every return, as the highliner, the captain who always came home with his vessel loaded to the brim, overflowing with fish, rail to rail. And now he stood at the helm of Annie Anita, ready for another go, another challenge. Aye, but along with the thrill came the responsibility of getting the crew home safely, making sure they made a fair catch, a good haul to feed their families. He sized up his men now as they finished securing lines. His second hand, Tom Reed, towered over the others. A giant of a man, he always met Paddy's gaze straight on and followed orders without a fight. Reed could be counted on to work hard, keep his wits about him, and take command if needed. Paddy recited the other crew names in his head. John Brinton, George Mitchell, Dominic Walsh, Charles Hanrahan, and Edward Clark. Good men, each had sailed with Paddy many a time. With the exception of Dominic, who was soon to be married, all of the other crew members had children and wives depending on them. Paddy never forgot the men had families at home, waiting and worrying, families that prayed for their safe return. He had never lost a man in his years as skipper. And despite the dorymen's unspoken worries about this journey and the August gales, Paddy was not about to lose a member of his crew now. As the sun rose higher, it colored the dawn like a kaleidoscope with streaks of pink and peach. Paddy searched for oncoming clouds, clouds as gray as mackerel tails, but his eyes spied nothing but swaths of blue. "Aye, a fine day and a fine stretch of weather ahead," Paddy told himself. "Me boys will have a good trip." A few miles behind Paddy's vessel, James Walsh stood at the helm of Mary Bernice. James gripped the wheel and tried to contain the joy, the fierce pride, that threatened to burst through his chest. In the days before they sailed, his father Paddy had told him, "James, there's no describing it, no telling what it's like to captain a vessel, be your own man, your own boss, king of the sea." For years, James took orders from his father and other skippers, listened to their shouts and curses. But now he was in charge, the one who barked the orders, plotted the course, decided where to fish, and when to lower the dories over the side. Not long after they hoisted the sails that morning, a crew member had called him captain, and James had nodded nonchalantly. But silently he told himself, "I'm a captain." Since he was a small boy rowing dories in the bay, he dreamed of being a skipper, a highliner like his dad, out fishing, out sailing the other schooners. And now James had his chance, his own vessel to master, to command. Aye, his father was right. 'Twas no feeling like it. Nothing compared. Still, James knew his shoulders bore a tremendous responsibility. He had heeded the advice from his father. Respect the sea. Know its strength, its fearsome power. If ye don't, ye and your crew won't live very long. James watched his crew now as they stood on deck, the four men his father had handpicked: Richard Hanrahan, Dennis Long, Michael Farrell, and Billy Reed. Except for Reed, who was in his 20s, all of the other men were veteran sailors, dorymen who had seen their share of storms, gales, and had spent many days lost at sea, rowing their dories in fog and dark of night. He hoped to give them all a fair journey, find the fishing grounds that would offer them tubs of cod, a successful trip for his maiden voyage, a grand trip for them all. And, of course, James would like nothing more than to beat his father, to fill his hold first. But there was another reason he had hoped to land the cod quick and fast. He knew his wife, Lucy, wept over his absence. The image of her sobbing tormented him. In the hours before he departed, she sat by the kitchen stove, her feet swollen, her broad belly stretching the seams of her cloth dress. James had knelt at her feet and held her hand. "It will be all right, Lucy," he told her. "I'll be home in a week's time." "But what about the baby?" she cried. "It will be here soon. I want ye near." "I'll be by your side soon enough. The cold months are coming, and we won't be to sea then. I'll be here with ye through the winter, helping ye care for our wee child." Lucy wiped her tears, knowing there was little she could do. She knew James had desired to captain his schooner long before he met her. He had talked, dreamed, planned for this trip over the past 4 years. Now the time had come for James to stand at the helm, and Lucy understood that nothing, not even the birth of their child, could keep him ashore. She fingered the rosary beads in her lap and made the sign of the cross upon her forehead as her husband turned to leave. Her words, a plea loud and desperate, followed him out the door. "Mary, Mother of God, bring him safely home to our baby." Chapter 14. Welcome Home. Marystown, June 2003. The directions seem simple enough. "Turn left at Gooby's," my cousin Jack Brenton, Alan's son, tells us, "and just keep going straight till you hit Marystown." "Gooby's?" my father, sister, and I ask each other. After landing at St. John's, renting a car, and traveling 100 miles west along the transatlantic Canadian highway, we arrive in the small village of Gooby's. A community of near 200, the village is known among travelers as a place to gas up and get grub at the Irving petrol station. The rest stop is also renowned for Morris the Moose, a statue which towers over the parking lot. 10 feet tall, the sculpture was created as a reminder to tourists and Newfoundlanders to keep a careful eye out for the 110,000 moose that roam the province and cause up to 900 car accidents a year. Thankfully, dusk, the preferred time for moose to forage, is 3 hours away on this June evening as we leave Gooby's and head south. My cousin does not tell us much about the two-lane throughway that will take us through the Barrens and on to Marystown and the Buran Peninsula, but we soon learn it will be a long and lonely ride. For the next 90 minutes, we will see few cars and minimal signs of civilization. 10,000 years ago, glaciers ravaged this land, scraping the terrain of its topsoil and trees. What remains are the barrens, miles and miles of rocks, boulders, and cliffs, remnants of mountains that were broken up by ancient sheets of gigantic ice. Aside from occasional birds, we see no other evidence of life. The stark landscape stretches south for nearly 100 miles, testing our eyes after a full day of travel. My father, tired and still uneasy about this trip, utters the first of many, "Jesus Christ, where the hell is Marystown?" Joni and I smile and say nothing, figuring we haven't a clue where Marystown is anyway. We take turns driving, and as I focus on the flat stretch of road ahead, I muse that it could be worse. The fog that often shrouds Newfoundland in the summer, endangering fishermen and sailors, would make this ride particularly unpleasant. The sheets of mist would blind us and put us at even more risk of hitting one of the myriad of animals, bears, coyotes, caribou, and moose, that roam the barrens. I take careful note of the bright yellow road signs that depict a moose and a crushed car. An hour or so into our journey, we are heartened by the sight of villages and harbors. We read markers for Petit Fort, Rushoon, Red Harbor, towns that lie to the east on the shores of Placentia Bay. Settled in the early 16th century, the Placentia Bay communities were named by the European fishermen who were drawn to Newfoundland's bountiful waters. Portuguese, French, Irish, English, Spanish, and Basque fishermen sailed along Newfoundland's shores, eager to hunt cod, the bottom-feeding fish that British explorer John Cabot noted were so plentiful that they could be plucked from the sea with a basket weighted down with stone. "The sea is swimming with fish," Cabot reported, when he claimed the island in the North Atlantic as Newfound Land for King Henry VII in 1497. 4 centuries later, I picture Paddy sailing the bays of Placentia and St. Mary's, the hold of his schooner filled with layer upon layer of cod. I see the sails of Annie Anita stretched tight against the wind, with Jerome and Frankie on board, as the schooner slices through the water on its August journey. I am eager to reach Marystown and to stand along the bay, where Paddy's crew unfurled his sails and heaved the anchor on that warm summer morning. I am excited, too, to see Paddy's home, the old Molly Hotel bought for his wife Lil. Fortunately, the 120-year-old house is still standing, and is owned by my cousin, Alan Brenton, who has done little to change the historic building. I am anxious to step inside, to walk along the pine floors where Paddy, Lillian, and their children once stepped. The summer sun continues to sink lower in the sky, and after traveling nearly 2 hours along this bleak highway, we are restless to arrive in Marystown, the largest of the 5 communities on the boot-shaped Burren Peninsula. "Jesus Christ," my father mutters again, exasperated. "I wish I had a beer." Spotting a roadside shop, we pull over to stretch our legs, get beer, and buy a gift for our relatives. Inside the store, which is actually a garage of sorts, Joni and I find a sparse collection of groceries: milk, bread, cereal, cigarettes, beer, and liquor. We explain to the woman who presides over the premises that we're looking for a present for our relatives. She quickly suggests Screech, Newfoundland's beloved 100-proof rum. I will later learn the liquor received its name in the early 1900s, after an American commanding officer was offered a shot of the caramel-colored liquid as an after-dinner cordial. Seeing his Newfoundland host toss back the drink, the officer did the same. Not prepared for the scorching sensation as the liquor traveled down his throat, the officer let out a loud and anguished howl. His scream drew the attention of his sergeant, who pounded on the door and asked, "What the cripes was that ungodly screech?" A Newfoundlander replied, "The screech, 'tis the rum, me son." The setting sun burns the clouds orange and violet as we begin to see houses along the road, signs of an oncoming community. Marystown, we hope. Soon a roadside sign informs us we are indeed in my grandfather's birthplace. "Thank God," we tell each other, relieved that our arduous day of travel is nearly over. Not long after we enter the town, we find our relative's business, Brenton Rentals and Sales, which is co-owned by Jack and his father, Alan. We pull up to the large garage doors and yard where several large tractors and excavators loom. Inside the garage bays, the Brentons are waiting for us. They shake our hands and offer hugs, telling us, "Welcome home." Both Alan and Jack are eager to meet Ambrose's firstborn son and his granddaughters. They consider our side of the family a bit of a mystery, the relatives who were never heard from, the family that chose to disavow its Newfoundland roots. Years ago, through Ambrose, the Brentons have heard bits and pieces about our lives. They know that my father was a successful engineer who at one time managed hundreds of employees. They know he has a home in New Hampshire, a wife, Patricia, six daughters, and several grandchildren. And they understand, after phone calls and emails with my father, that he is apprehensive about this trip and meeting strangers, relatives who are familiar with far too many details of his life and the life of the man who abandoned him. After a few minutes of awkward conversation, my father, Joni, and I realize that the Brentons are sincerely excited that we have traveled to Marystown. While Jack gives us a tour of his offices, Alan silently studies my father, considering the likeness between my dad and Ambrose. He notes their similar build, their tall, muscular frames. Alan also takes a quick liking to my father, whose confident nature and affable manner remind him of his uncle Ambrose. Still, Alan is careful not to say too much about my grandfather on our first night. An astute businessman, adept at reading customers' wants and needs, Alan saves details and conversations about Ambrose for later, some of which will be difficult for my father to hear. While Alan is more reserved and quiet, his son Jack, a 35-year-old man with a family of his own, is jovial and outgoing. He feels comfortable with us soon after we meet. "It was like I knew ye all my life," he will later tell me. "He felt like family pretty fast." The Brentons' hospitality quickly sets my father at ease. Joni, too, is surprised at our cousins' friendly nature, and she wonders about their resilience, their ability to thrive in such a struggling community. She sizes up their looks, their features, disappointed that they do not share our family's likeness, our dark hair, our freckled skin. I am struck by the sound of the Brentons' voices. When Jack and Alan speak, their tone is lyrical, sing-song, like the Irish brogue that was first spoken in Marystown and other southeastern outports in the mid-1800s. Their conversation is infused with "aye," "right on," and "ye," and I am comforted by this connection to our Irish ancestors. "Right, so why don't we give yees a quick tour of Marystown before we head out to camp, aye?" Jack suggests. We nod and follow the Brentons in their car, past Tim Hortons, McDonald's, the town's one traffic light, and over the Cannery Bridge, which was built in the 1950s, to connect Marystown's southern and northern shores. The bay that leads east to the sea is dark and rippled by a slight evening breeze. Here, Paddy's schooners once moored. Here, he unloaded thousands of pounds of cod, his catch drawing a crowd of young and old fishermen who marveled at his skill in finding the fish. Across the bridge we turn left, and stop before a hill that slopes down the road. A three-story house looms above us. Several of its windows are boarded, the paint is peeling, and the two chimneys are crumbling. Still, the sight of my great-uncle's home mesmerizes me. I picture Paddy slamming shut his broad front door and walking along the footpath to the wharf. He would have strolled along on the road where we now stand. I envision young boys carefully doffing their caps and offering, "Evening, Captain Paddy, sir." I hear Frankie and Jerome running after their da, hollering as they raced toward the Annie Anita, eager to climb the rigging, place their small hands on the helm. And here we've reached the end of Episode 8 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall, and thank you for listening.